Blog Talk Radio.
That jingle by Adam Spiegel to get me pumped up for Mets baseball. It is now. We are here. It is spring. Basically, I didn't see a winner. Did you guys? Welcome to the Metsian podcast. This is Sam Maxwell, the converted Mets fan. And yes, that is from the Yankees. So welcome to the spring. Let's, before we bring on our main featured guest, I don't mean to diminish your accomplishments, Mestradamus, but J.J. Newman will give us the baseball player insight coming up later on, and we welcome that. So welcome again to all our listeners. Thank you for listening. And we will first bring on Mestradamus. You know, since I threw you your name out, usually we, of course, bring on a Metsian roundtable specifically, but I'm going to go to you first, John Coppinger. Hi, welcome.
Hi. Thank you very much. And I don't know if I have accomplishments to diminish, so you don't ever have to worry about that.
All the way up I-95 North, as I like to say, because this is such a vast tri-state we belong to, is Rich Spirago in Connecticut. How you doing, Rich?
Hey, Sam, how are you? It's good to hear your voice again. It's been a while since we've been on the air, and it's always great to talk to John. I'm looking forward to talking to JJ as well. As we, spring training has started. Pitchers and catchers started yesterday, and first games will be played a week from tomorrow. The Mets do not play a week from tomorrow. They play Saturday, but the first actual major league games week from tomorrow. So we're on the cusp.
We are on the cusp. This is the time, you know, usually I am a little enveloped in all of this, but, you know, kind of life gets to you, and sometimes you can't watch Justin Verlander next to the locker until a few hours before now while you're making the post for this podcast. And I'll start with you, John Mestradamus. When it comes to going into 2023, and we haven't been on air since Carlos Correa signed a contract with Minnesota, and I have many thoughts on that. We're going to cover it briefly because there's so much other things to get to. But when it comes to this offseason, how do you view it from the overall standpoint?
Hey, overall, I think it was a success for sure. The Mets filled every hole that was created by the departure of players. So it's not DeGrom leaves, they get Verlander. They get rid of James McCann. They get Omar Narvaez. Excuse me. They lose Chris Bassett. They get Kodai Senga. excuse me, who I'm very excited for, and they get Jose Quintana as the fourth starter when they lose Taijuan Walker. So every hole that was created by players leaving, and players are going to leave, they went and they filled it. And it's really all that you can ask of a team. Now, Correa would have been that one over-the-top signing that would have just set everybody on fire. And they tried. They certainly tried. But they were prudent about the medicals, which teams in the past – and listen, we've rooted for Met teams that didn't – managements that didn't give out physicals before signing players, whether JJ puts. But so listen, I think it was a success. I think, yes, remember him? So I think definitely it was an overall success. I mean, we'll see how these players perform. We'll see how Senga and Quintana acclimate to New York. And we'll see what happens with the offense that is relatively unchanged from last year, but hopefully you get some bounce backs and you get some performances from new guys like Brett Beatty at third base, and away we go. I really have no lingering complaints.
No disparage to JJ Putz, I think he's probably a really cool guy and a great player. But it's just funny you mentioning another JJ on an episode that we're going to have JJ. I do believe it's probably you'd rather be a Newman than a Putz. But anyway, I digress. Yeah. Anyway, Rich, I will segue this way since we got the overview by Metstradamus. Who I'm not sure how much you predicted, but you may have predicted some. Rich, when thinking about the conversations, you know, he mentioned all the different pieces in the starting rotation that the Mets took care of to replace who left. So would you say the two conversations, and of course go into the overview for sure, but I will start the segue to you with this. Do you think the two conversations in the starting rotation are age, considering you have Max Scherzer, Justin Verlander, and Carlos Carrasco, as well as how Kodai Senga acclimates to the major leagues?
I think that's hitting the nail on the head very squarely. I think, here's something I'd like to share. So Jim Duquette does, as we know, former Mets GM, and he's on SNY. He's a regular on Mets Hot Stove. So last night on Hot Stove, he said something that I think is very telling. He said what the Mets should do, in his opinion, and he said if he were the GM, he would work with the manager to try to have 28 starts each for Verlander and Scherzer, regardless of their health. That's assuming they're in good health. So right there, there's an acknowledgement that these guys are, you know, getting up there in age. And of course, we know that, but it's a real thing. You know, he was saying for a team like this that, let's face it, in all likelihood should be in the postseason, thinking about the postseason on day one and try to do, you know, sometimes 6 days between starts. I think he said something I did not know, which was Verlander, I think only, what was it, three or four of his starts were on 4 days rest. That most of them were on five or more. So start managing. I think he made 28 starts last year. So start managing to the postseason right away because of their age. So right there, age is factoring into this rotation. Kodai Senga, I mean, it was a sexy signing for sure. You know, you get a guy like that with a ghost pork ball and all of that. How will he acclimate to the different ball in the U.S., the different hitters? You know, hopefully he'll have the advantage seeing these hitters for the first time this year. You know, they have to adjust to him and all of that. But this rotation is going to be determined by how these older pitchers, Carrasco included, hold up and how Senga does. Right. And Quintana's 34, I believe. He'll be 34 before the season starts. So while that's still fairly young, I mean, that's not 26 either. So, yeah, I think it's a big deal, actually. And when you have to start thinking about, you know, before you throw your first pitch on March 30th, you have to start thinking about limiting starts, maybe limiting innings, so you have these guys ready for the postseason. How can you not say age is a factor, right?
So, Metstradamus, John, sorry, I won't keep doing that combination the way it's ordered. I won't keep saying your internet name the entire episode. But my question for you, John, when you think about the starting rotation that Rich just shouted out, that the Mets do have, and you know, of course, we just talked about where you proceed with caution. However, on paper, as we are wont to do around this time, wow, like that puts people like Joey Lucchese and Tyler McGill and, unfortunately, not Trevor Williams, but that's just me. You know, like people like that are able to both possibly be part of the bullpen and as well as depth in the minor leagues. So, like that rotation for a team that won 101 games is definitely, as far as I can say, on paper an improvement.
It's absolutely an improvement because it's deep. It goes five deep if everybody has repeats the success that they've had in stretches last year. And there are ways to manage Scherzer and Verlander. You've got days off that you can slip guys in. You've got, like you said, you've got Tylor McGill, and don't forget about David Peterson and Joey Lucchese. And listen, I've been a proponent of having long guys in the bullpen for occasions where you don't want your starters to go past five innings early in the season. You don't want Justin Verlander pitching in cold weather. When was the last time Justin Verlander pitched in cold weather regularly? It was with Detroit, so it hasn't been for a while. So, but there are ways to do that, and I think that going deeper, because you've got the two 40-year-olds at the top of the rotation, going deeper with Quintana and Senga was the play more than throwing a bunch of money at Carlos Rodon, who I think could have a very good year with the Yankees. But I think for the Mets' needs, they needed to go as deep as possible in that rotation so that McGill, guys like McGill and Peterson are depth guys and not guys that you have to depend on every fifth day. And if you had to, listen, they've had success at various points. McGill was on his way to a great season before he got hurt. So we'll see. We'll see how it's – I don't envy Buck's mission in terms of getting everybody the time that they want to play and to keep everybody healthy.
Yeah, agreed. And as long as we're still on the topic of the starting rotation, we're starting with that, pun intended. Rich, you know, there's two things to segue to you with. It's both the potential gripe past younger, almost like, I guess, 15 years ago, Justin Verlander and Max Scherzer had with each other. I forget, Rich, before I continue and pass it back over to me, when did they go to the World Series with Detroit? This was 2012 or not?
2012.
I'm sorry. 2012 against the Giants. Okay. Right. Exactly. So 10 years ago, basically, 11 years ago by October. So they're two different types of people now. And, so regardless of whatever the rumor is, this is my A question, do you think it's going to get in the way, even though people are kind of talking about it as being kind of a competitive thing and may have even fueled the World Series run? So that's a question about those two and what it means for the clubhouse, as well as the DeGrom news that basically within, I think it was like 50 minutes, of him walking into the place, he had some tightness. Jacob DeGrom.
Well, yes, to address those, I've heard both Scherzer and Verlander, they've both been questioned about their cool relationship, competitive relationship in Detroit. And they both acknowledged it. Like, they don't say, oh, my God, that's no, like that. They basically say, well, you know, we were trying to push each other and we were competitive and it came from that place of being competitive and wanting to be the best. And it was that. It wasn't that they didn't like each other. It's just that they both wanted to be the alpha male. And on Hot Stove last night, or might have been Baseball Night in New York, Terry Collins said that's a good thing, right? He goes, if those guys were cool with each other because they were competing with each other to be the best, that's not a bad thing, that's a good thing. And he said, yes, it's been 10 years or a little bit less since they've been teammates. And so they both had kids since then. You know, they've both done a lot of things in their careers. You know, Scherzer's won a World Series since then, as has Verlander, and so with other teams. And so they might not – and if they're competitive with each other – again, I'll go with Terry on this one. That's not a bad thing. That could push them. And if they're not, if they've matured, to use a word, and they find a way to get along better, their veteran leadership in the clubhouse will work. So either way, it's probably not a bad thing. I mean, if they push each other or if they just, you know, come together and sing Kumbaya and have and create that great clubhouse environment. Hey guys, you know, follow us. We're winners. It's good either way. So I have no concern with that at all. I think that people are fishing for something when they start try to make that a story, frankly. And it's been very boring around the Mets before the pitchers and catchers reported. So I can understand why, but I think it's a non-issue. Secondly, DeGrom. This is going to sound like hindsight, but I thought the Mets were right to walk away. I would never have given him more than 3 years. When he was a free agent, I said, give him 3 years at Scherzer money. That makes sense. Match Scherzer, you know, out of respect to DeGrom and what he can do, make him equally paid to Scherzer for 3 years, no more than that. He's way too fragile to lock him up for 5 or 6 years, or I think we got like six, I think, right? So, and you're seeing it now. Now, he may go out and have a great year, but spring training, tightness. It's just the beat goes on with this guy. He'll probably have some great starts with the Rangers over the next 3 years. He'll probably do a lot of time on the IL. History best predicts the future, and that's probably what will happen here. I don't wish it upon him at all. To me, you know, and I don't know, and I'd be interested to get your guys' perspective on this. To me, when a player leaves the team I root for, I'm neutral on that player. Like, he's just a guy in another team. I'm not going to, if I'm at Citi Field, if DeGrom takes the mound for the Rangers, I'm not going to stand up and give him a standing ovation. I'm not going to boo him. He's just another competitor to me. And it was like that with Seaver. When Seaver was traded, he came back to the Reds, he came back as a Red. Like, okay, Mets go out there and win the game. I didn't really give a crap. You know, it's just I don't root against the guy. I don't root for him. I'm neutral. And that's why I am with DeGrom. I don't wish bad on the guy. I don't necessarily say, you know, I'm going to root for him no matter what. I'm just neutral personally. So I'd be curious as to your takes on that.
I'd like to respond to that if possible.
Yeah.
Please.
Yeah.
With DeGrom, I'll always appreciate what he's done here. And I think when he comes back, if I'm fortunate enough to be at that game, I will give him a standing ovation. But since he left and since he made it clear that because DeGrom to me is the absolute opposite of the Freddie Freeman scenario with Atlanta, where he left and you knew he was sad about it, and you knew that it affected him, and it took him some months to get over. DeGrom seemed to be over it right away. Like, I'm signing with Texas, and it was done, and it was clean. And then we had to wait, 3 weeks for the thank you in the paper from DeGrom, which doesn't really bother me either way, but you know that his PR people had to nudge him to do it after all the complaining about it. And then to hear him in the press conference just talk about nothing, you know, not look back at all, and just go forward with, you know, the Rangers and talking about them like he's known them for years, like Boak and Boach and this and that and all the nicknames. It's like, all right, he's cut himself off. And that's fine. God bless him. I'll give him the ovation. But I'm like you, Rich. I'm neutral towards him. You know, the Mets have two Hall of Famers still at the top of the rotation and a team that has a shot to win the World Series. I wish DeGrom well, but I'm looking forward.
Exactly.
So, you know, I think it's interesting. It should be noted that, you know, part of the bittersweetness of Jacob DeGrom leaving is the fact that the Mets' top four pitchers in their history, you could argue, Jacob DeGrom, well, I'll start with Tom Seaver, of course, but Jacob DeGrom, the aforementioned Tom Seaver, as well as Dwight Gooden and let's throw Jerry Kuzman in there, didn't finish their career as a Met. And that's something to be noted as bittersweet. And I'm going to say it's interesting getting a player's perspective on all of this as we welcome former Mets draft pick J.J. Newman to the program. J.J., first of all, you still look like every time I see you that like you can play.
I try to eat right and I try to exercise every day, and I really like that compliment, man. But I try to stay in shape, and, you know, I'm coaching now and everything, so I have to be able to throw the ball around every day. So I'm one of those guys that, you know, I'm fortunate enough to still have an active lifestyle.
So you were drafted in 2006, which is such an interesting intersection of all of Mets baseball and the entire organization as a whole. So what are you doing with yourself these days when it comes to baseball?
So I do this. I talk on podcasts, talk on a couple TV shows back in Wheeling, West Virginia, down in West Palm Beach. I coach a team out of Connecticut now, the Clubhouse. So they're one of the top-ranked teams in the country for high school guys. And I'm doing that three times a week. I do private lessons. So basically my entire life hasn't shifted away from the game when I retired. It's basically maintain baseball in every facet. So still enjoying life and still acting like a little kid and playing the game and teaching the game I love.
So, you know, this is something that I didn't think would necessarily come up on this podcast, but I just have to bring it up, you know. Like,
yeah.
There's a lot of players out there that if they don't quote-unquote make it, but it seems like there's a lot of different ways of making it. If they don't quote-unquote make it, it's hard for them to watch the game. But it just seems, for you especially, that regardless of what is considered quote-unquote making it, you know that there's a role for you in baseball, and you just want to continue to get back to the game.
Yes, exactly. Even, you know, the Mets and I didn't part on bad terms at all. You know, I'm still friends with all the front office guys there and the coaches and stuff like that. And even when I retired, they were offering jobs like you could come back as a scout, you'd come back and help us with spring training and, you know, be an instructor, a roving guy. So we didn't part on bad terms at all. And, you know, I kind of knew then, and I was getting coaching jobs and college offered to me and stuff like that. So I knew then, like, okay, I don't have to leave the game. And, you know, my best friend ended up playing for the New York Giants, so I stayed up here in New York and ended up starting giving private lessons and still was offered, like, coaching jobs for high school kids and stuff like that. And people said I had a personality or a little bit of one, so I started talking on TV and doing this type of stuff. So it's just, it hasn't left me. I haven't been forced to go back and get a degree or look for another job opportunity. I've been able to, you know, stay around the game, and it's just been, it's truly been a blessing. I've been one of the fortunate enough guys to do that. I haven't had to, you know, switch gears and go into insurance or go into, you know, going back to school and figuring it out or anything. So it's truly been a blessing, and, you know, I love it. I wake up every day, and it's like I don't have to go to work. It's just, okay, I'm going to a ball field, or I'm going to train and or talk baseball. You know, it was my dream growing up, and it's just been, it's been awesome. Now I get to talk baseball with you guys all the time.
Exactly, JJ. It sounds like, in my mind, you have figured it out. So that's great.
Yeah.
So when you hear us, you heard some of that DeGrom conversation, you know, put yourself in his shoes. As well as just your overall take on the entire thing.
You know, well, listen to you guys and hearing a lot of fans and stuff like that, there's usually two ways to look at the game or just sports in general. You have a lot of the people that love a certain team and they're passionate about their team, and I totally get that. And then you have a lot of people that they love the sport and they love the players in them. So for me, for instance, I never really had a favorite team. I just liked watching certain players. I grew up, you know, watching Jeter play, watching Ken Griffey play. So it wasn't like, oh, my gosh, I'm a Pittsburgh Pirate fan or a Yankees fan. It was just like, is Jeter playing tonight or is Ken Griffey playing tonight? So I was that type of guy. However, I definitely respect the guys. I heard earlier, I don't know which one of you guys was saying it, but they said, you know, I'm not giving DeGrom a standing ovation. And, you know, that type of attitude is what, like, makes baseball so much fun, because it's a diehard fan. And I don't care if you come back or not, I'm standing up for you. And I love that. Like, I love that, because that's what breeds rivalries and all that stuff. I'm not that type of guy, but I definitely respect that. And that's, you know, that's what makes the game fun. But being a fan, like, I grew up right outside of Pittsburgh. I kind of like the Pirates. I like Barry Bonds growing up. But, you know, I got to a certain age where I started playing, and I kind of knew what I was going to end up doing with this game and playing. And I stopped kind of being a fan of a team and just follow players and appreciate what they do. And, you know, it's just been, even since then, I like watching Mike Trout play. I'm not an Angels fan at all. I do root for the Mets. I will say I am a little partial now. And, Sam, you know, anytime I see you, we always have great discussions about it. And I really follow them. And I, you know, most of the times that I'm on either TV or doing the podcast thing, people are generally asking Mets questions and stuff like that. But, you know, I'm a fan more of, like, the player entity. I like the player side of it. And I appreciate good players. I actually really appreciate mature players, guys that handle the game and respect it really well. And those are the type of players that I follow. So I'm more of a player type of guy than just an individual team thing. But, you know, whenever I walk in and see you, Sam, I'm a Mets fan all the way.
So the Pittsburgh Pirates, and it makes perfect sense since when I'm going over to Chicago, I got to cross through Wheeling if I'm coming from Pittsburgh. It's basically if the Pittsburgh Pirates are in the World Series, you're walking around Wheeling, Virginia, West Virginia, you're seeing a lot of Pirates hats.
Oh my gosh, Wheeling, West Virginia. Yes, if Pittsburgh is in the World Series, I'm telling you right now, it's going to be an all night long party in Wheeling, West Virginia when that happens. Because I remember a couple of years ago, I was actually covering it on TV for my hometown station there, and the Pirates made the wild card, and it was the most insane experience at PNC Park in Pittsburgh. It was sold out, obviously. But it was so loud, and the fans are so passionate there that even, like, the ESPN cameras and everything, when something happened, were shaking. Like, it was noticeable on TV that the crowd was so loud, it was shaking. I remember, I forget who was on the mound. It might have been Cueto.
Johnny
somebody
Cueto.
He
dropped the ball in the block, yes. I was thinking of that as you were talking about the last time the Pirates were in the World Series, that moment, and then the next pitch he gives up a home run.
And the next
the wild card, of course, but Freudian
slip, of
course.
Yes, exactly. It was so amazing, you know, seeing that. And that, you know, Wheeling is 30, 45 minutes outside of Pittsburgh, so basically West Virginia doesn't have its own professional sports teams like in the NFL, NBA, or MLB, so everybody kind of gravitates towards Pittsburgh. You know, you'll have one or two guys that are Cleveland fans or whatever. They're known as the outcasts. But we're all Pittsburgh guys back there, and anytime they go to the Super Bowl, they go to the World Series, it is an electric atmosphere there. You know, I'm not a Philadelphia fan at all, but I, you know, was fortunate enough I went to the World Series for a couple games this year down there, and it reminded me of Pittsburgh, like that electric fan base, that blue-collar fan base. Like, it's great for sports. And seeing games in Pittsburgh, whenever they do well, is amazing. However, those years with baseball are usually few and far between, unfortunately for my friends back home. But yeah, Pittsburgh's amazing. And you go through the friendly city of Wheeling, man. You got to stop and have a beer there. They got a couple good bars for you, Sam.
Yeah, I gotta check it out for sure. I've only actually passed over the bridge, so that is something. That is a thing, you know. And I think that's kind of like a lot of Mets fans, you know, hate the Phillies, but there's I will always root for the Phillies over the Braves, like I did last year. There just seems to be, because of maybe the Northeast, you know, it's a similar blue collar fan base, and sometimes you have a lot of both friends as well as family that overlap. I think but at the same time, I've met a lot of great Braves fans, so it's just bottom line, I think, like, there's all different reasons why we root for other teams when our team isn't in the playoffs, but I digress. JJ, I'm going to want to talk about with you Florida spring training, but I want to pass it over to my other compadres on the podcast right now. And I'm going to start with Rich Spirago, who is one of my co-hosts on the Metsian podcast.
Awesome. Sounds good.
Hey, Rich. Rich, you there?
Oop, I was on mute. Sorry. Hey, JJ, nice to have you. Nice to have you on again.
Oh, thanks, man. Good to talk to you again, Rich.
So, yeah, I guess my question would be, well, I have two questions. One, I happen to live in Connecticut, so I'm interested to know where the team is that you're coaching. Maybe I can come by and check you guys out. That's the first question.
Absolutely.
And then secondly, you know, as when I'm a little bit older than you guys, you know, so when I was a kid, they say that players used to get in shape in spring training, right? They would have off-season jobs and all that kind of stuff. When they got to spring training, they would try to lose the weight, they would run, they'd get ready. Obviously, that's much different now. The athletes are their bodies are like immaculate, you know, all off-season. What was it like for you? What I'm interested in is when you were going to go to spring training in February, not so much what was February like, what was October through late January like? What did you do to stay in shape? Because, you know, you were, you know, like 2006, so you're obviously in the era of athletes being in shape all year long. What did you do when you weren't at a facility? How did you stay in shape?
Right. You know what? I was very fortunate, and this is the situation a lot of guys fall in, where when they get drafted or whatever, they do have to go back and work in the off season, and or go back to their countries and do other things, and they don't have, you know, access to everything that they actually need to really get their bodies in shape and stuff. And I was very fortunate. My family supported me so much, my sisters and mom. And I was also, during college, I was one of the guys that worked out constantly. So instead of Friday night going to a frat house or a party, I was in the gym until midnight, you know, with the ex-pro guys coming back to visit us and stuff like that. And I was waking up, hitting balls on Saturday morning, working out Saturday. So I already had that lifestyle. And once I did get drafted, my best friend actually played for the Kansas City Royals at the time. We got a place in New Orleans together. So we lived in New Orleans in the off season, and we trained 24/7 at Pelican Athletic Club down there. We worked out for 2-3 hours a day. Then they had like all the fields and stuff supplied to us. Like we could go throw, we could go hit. We had batting cages, even if the weather was bad. So it was still like I might have taken 2 or 3 days off at the end of the season and went back to West Virginia with my family for a couple days. But then I was right down in New Orleans, and I went down there until Christmas, maybe went back to Christmas for 2 or 3 days to West Virginia, and then I went right back down to New Orleans and got after it. And, you know, there was about 3 or 4 other pro guys, a couple football guys in the NFL, and we all trained together, you know. So I was very, very fortunate that when I showed up to spring training, my goal was to show up like it was mid-season. I didn't want to show up like, okay, I got to get my timing down because I haven't seen a 95-mile-an-hour fastball in 4 months. I got to get my body in shape because I haven't sprinted. I haven't lifted weights. I'm not used to swinging a bat 150 times a day. I wanted to show up first day of spring training, show these guys like I meant business. I busted my ass in the off season, and I'm ready to go. So I was real fortunate that I had my family supporting me. I had friends that were kind of in the same shoes as I was and just as passionate. So, you know, we had a buddy system. You know, we got up 6 a.m. every day, went and worked out, went and hit, went through, did all our stuff. We ate right. We ate clean. We didn't party a lot. You know, and being in New Orleans, that was kind of tough, you know, not to say let's go down to Bourbon Street and have a couple hand grenades and a couple whiskeys, but we stayed off of it and remained focused. And the goal is, and like you said, a lot of guys were showing up and they were like trying to use spring training as this is going to get us ready for the season, when guess what? You're behind the eight ball at that point. Those guys want you to show up, and your organization wants you to show up mid-season form. They don't want to have to get you in shape. You know, they always say, yeah, pitchers and catchers come to get their arms. Like, the pitchers and catchers have been throwing. They've already been throwing. They're showing up to show you what they have and to get prepared, you know, to go over the approach in the games and stuff like that. It's not like they show up throwing 85 and they have to get ready to throw 95, you know, in 2 weeks. They show up ready with their stuff. So that was my goal. That was my personal goal, you know, show up day one, show the organization that I'm ready to rock and roll, show the organization that, you know, I busted my butt. This means the world to me. It's my, you know, I don't have any distractions in the off season or anything like that. And they run you, the Mets, anyways, run you through tests on the first day. You know, running tests, throwing tests, you know, weight tests, all this to see where everybody's at. And I know guys that got released by the third day of spring training because they showed up out of shape, you know, and, you know, it was bad. But I tried to show up just like it was mid-season. So I would get together also with pitchers in the off season. You know, hey, guys, come down to New Orleans, you know, in the middle of January, come down. If you want to throw, I want to stand in and hit while you throw, because I had a couple buddies that were catchers down there too. So we literally had – we prepared the best way you could, you know, to get ready. However, when you go down in spring training in Florida in the hot sun and humidity, that's one thing to get prepared for too. You know, you got to hydrate every day and get ready for it. And the guys that, you know, are coming from Wisconsin and Michigan that, you know, they're leaving 30 and 40 degree weather and coming down there, you could tell that was getting to them too. So, but yeah, my goal was to show up every year to show the organization, you know, I came prepared. I've been busting my butt. I wasn't sitting on the couch eating Doritos and playing video games all off season, you know. So that was my goal. And that was most of the guys' goals, but I was fortunate enough that it was pretty easy to do. And the other question you asked, the team I'm coaching, it's called the Clubhouse. And I was approached by Mike Porzio. This was back in August. He's a 10-year Major League vet, pitched for the White Sox for a long time, Colorado Rockies, bunch of teams. And he started this Clubhouse team in Connecticut, and now they're ranked every year nationally in the top 20. The program overall is ranked in the top 10, and now I'm the head coach of one of their teams. And it's just been a great experience. I always said I was never going to coach a team since I retired. However, since I've been doing it, it's just been amazing. We went to the World Championships down in Florida in the fall. Bunch of my kids are signed to really big schools, looking forward to the draft this year. And it's just been a great experience. And, you know, transitioning these kids from what they think, you know, is hard work to telling them my story and how hard I worked and seeing them hit another level, you know, with their progression, it's just been amazing. So, yeah, it's in Fairfield, Connecticut. I believe the closest games that we play around here in Boston, they have a perfect game tournament up there. We're in Atlanta, I know Fort Myers, Alabama, San Diego. There's a bunch of places we have to travel to. So it's hard to get us, you know, for people locally to see us. But it's just, it's been awesome, you know, to be in that position, especially when I never thought I was going to coach again. But it's been great. It really has. So how's everything since the last time I've been on this podcast?
Well, since
you want to
the
take
last
that,
time
Sam?
You've been on this podcast, yeah, I think the last time you've been on this podcast, it became a different podcast. The last time you were on this podcast, I believe it was the Rising Apple Report, and now, shout out to them, or not exactly a report because it retired with us, but welcome to the Metsian podcast, JJ, your inaugural visit to it.
Yes.
We're going to pass it on to Metstradamus John Coppinger.
And it's such a pleasure to hear your perspective, JJ, specifically on the DeGrom thing, because I try to tell people all the time that professional athletes don't think like you and me. They don't think like fans. It's nice to know you kind of do, but I do like that you do think a little differently than us fans who always like to say, oh, he should come back and play for us because he's going to win here and this and that. You know, it's not the only – it's not the only thing that players think about, especially as they get older. So I really do appreciate your perspective, and I'm happy to be here with you. I got a few quick hitters for you, if you can. Back when you played in the minors, you know, a lot of people, a lot of the talk recently has been about living wages, getting minor leaguers living wages. Was there a lot of talk about that amongst the players when you played? Or was it just you didn't really know that was a possibility, so you just never talked about it? My second question to you is, now that you're the coach of a team, How do you coach the kids in terms of, because you said you always appreciated the mature players, the ones who had respect for the game. How do you pass along respect for the game in an era where everybody wants to bat flip or and celebrate wildly? And I'm not saying that I'm against that at all. I'm curious to know your perspective on that. And then my third quick question is your favorite place to eat when you were on the road.
Awesome. Those are really good questions. Actually, last one sounds like a question I would ask on a panel. but yeah, your first question with the wages and minor league wages and stuff. And I mean, you know, you have to look at it. A lot of guys that actually get drafted get pretty good signing bonuses, so it doesn't affect them. However, some of the late drafts, the senior signs and stuff like that don't. Now, depending on which organization you're fortunate enough to get drafted by, usually the even if you get paid bare minimum, it might be $500 every 2 weeks. I forget what it's at right now. Usually they take care of everything anyway. So it's not like you're paying rent. It's not like you're paying, you know, payments for anything else. They take care of your house. They take care of your transportation. And they take care of your food. So when I was with the Mets, I didn't dip into my signing bonus. I didn't dip into anything while I played because literally they fly you from where you're at to training camp. You stay in a team hotel. They give you 3 meals a day. They give you your protein shakes after you work out. They give you all the supplements you need. They give you a house your transportation to and from. All that jazz is taken care of. So it really didn't affect me that much, but I know some other organizations, like you got to find a hotel, you got to find an apartment or whatever it is, and that just comes into a lot of people don't realize every organization's different. And I was fortunate enough that, you know, the top five organizations to get drafted to are the New York Yankees, the New York Mets, the Dodgers, the Cardinals, I would say the Chicago Cubs, like as far as taking care of their players, like, you know, you don't have to worry about anything. Yeah, you get paid a bare minimum, but you're there to play baseball, and usually you're at the field, you know, 12 to 14 hours a day. So there's not much else you need money for in my eyes, and I didn't, so it really didn't affect me at all when it came down to that. So other guys, I get it. Like, maybe they want to go out, maybe they want to do other stuff, but my focus was on baseball, and the team was taking care of everything I needed at that point, so it wasn't very, you know, it wasn't very hard for me, you know, with no money or anything else. I could get out there and play and not have to worry about, oh, my gosh, who's paying my bills or my apartment or this and that. You know, I stayed in team housing, ate all the food. We had a catering service at the hotel, so dinner would be taken care of or breakfast there. Then we had a cafeteria at the stadium, so everything was taken care of there also. And transportation to and from, our team had buses scheduled to go, you know, from the hotel to the stadium. And, you know, it was real easy. So that really didn't affect me too much. As far as second question, I hate the bat flip stuff. I hate the showboat stuff. You know, I was a guy that, and I'll tell you a quick story. The year I got drafted, you know, I was preseason, pretty much everybody knew if this guy has the year he should, he's getting drafted, he's pretty sought-after player and everything else. I remember the first game, first at bat, I'm the leadoff hitter. I hit a bomb over left field fence. First pitch of the season, left field fence, hit a bomb, and I bat flipped. I basically walked halfway up the line because it was probably 330 to the fence, and I hit it about 460, so it was a no-doubter. And I remember turning around second base and seeing half of the scouts, like, picking their bags up and already leaving. And I come around third base. My coach says, and he said, talk to me after this inning. Go in, sit down. He goes, don't you ever do that again, man. He goes, that's not you. I've never seen you do that. You don't bat flip. You don't show up the other pitcher. You don't do that stuff. And immediately I regretted it because I actually wasn't that type of pitcher. I don't know what came over me in that moment, but I did it. You know, and I'm actually glad I did it because it trained me, okay, don't do this in a real serious situation. And I'll never forget that. And in fact, after that year, every single major league team either flew me to their major league ballpark or came in to work me out at college. And every single team asked me about that. Like, you know, what happened that first ball you hit of the season? We understand it was the first pitch of the season and everything. You were probably excited, but we didn't understand the bat flip and everything else. And I said, you know, it was a lapse in judgment and character, and it was outside of my character. I'm not a cocky player. I don't showboat. I barely even talk during games. I'm focused. You know, I lead by example, and that's something that example was set, and it wasn't a good one. So, you know, I learned from that situation, and fast forward to this fall, you know, I train my guys that the only people we talk to on the field are our own players, our own teammates. We don't talk to the other team. We don't talk to the other coaches. We don't yell at umpires. We don't do all that because that's the fastest way you're either going to get kicked off of my team or you're going to sit on the pine next to me. So there was an incident this past fall where pitch outside to one of my players, and umpire called it a strike, and the kid looks at me like kind of confused, like, really? Which, okay, that's all right. And the other coach goes, good pitch, way to pitch. And my guy turned around and said, no, it wasn't, and talked back to the other coach. And they jawed for a second. I got in between it. I said, get out here and play. Everybody meet me on the field after this inning. We ended up getting out of that inning, and I told them all, I said, I don't care. We'll leave this field as a team and forfeit the game if I ever see that again. We respect the game. We don't talk to other coaches, let alone, like, as a player, you shouldn't be disrespecting another coach, whatever they're talking about or whatever they're arguing about. You don't talk to them. You don't disrespect the umpire. They're there to make bad calls. They're going to make bad calls. They're going to make good calls. So we don't acknowledge them either. We play between us, and we keep our head and our respect on the game. That's what we do. So we don't do that, and that's something, you know, that I bring up almost every day with these guys. I'm leaving Connecticut now, in fact, and had this talk, you know, with the guys. I just had my middle infielders working out and everything. Like, we play with respect. We respect the other team. We respect the other coaches, but we worry about ourselves. We don't do that showboating stuff. There's no bat flipping. There's none of this celebration stuff. You hit a home run, that's what I expect you to do. You make a good play, that's what I expect you to do. You know, I don't want to see all this stuff going on like you've never done it before. I made that mistake so you guys don't have to. So it's something that I don't accept. I really do not like it. When I watch it on TV and I see certain guys bat flipping and showing up and pounding their chest, it's like, really, how immature is this game gotten? Like, that should not be acceptable behavior. You know, I know we're all Mets fans here. We love them, but the one guy I always bring up is David Wright for the Mets and Derek Jeter for the Yankees. And, you know, I bring them up all the time and how they played the game with respect. They didn't showboat. They didn't show up opposing pitchers. I never remember David Wright acting like that or Derek Jeter. And those are guys that are class acts. They play, you know, they play the game the right way. And even opposing teams, even if you're a Mets fan and hate Derek Jeter, you still respect him. You're not going to say he's, you know, that guy's the biggest jerk I've ever seen, and I hate his character, I hate his morals, I hate that guy. You know, you might hate him as a player because he's on the team you can't stand, but you respect him. You know, and I'm sure Yankees fans felt that about David Wright as well. It's just certain players like that that you genuinely respect, and you could tell they respected the game, and that's how I'm trying to raise these guys and teach them how to play the game because, honestly, like I said, we're one of the best teams in the country, so the talent is there. And I want to make sure that when these guys are shortstop just signed to Boston College or a third baseman to Stanford, left fielder just signed to Pepperdine, I want to make sure that when our name's out there and these colleges sign them and they're like, oh, they played for JJ, you know, or Mike Porzio, that they know what type of player they're getting. They're getting a mature player that respects the game, works hard, and plays the game right. So, yeah, the entire climate of the game now with the bat flipping, the disrespecting people, you know, you got guys like Trevor Bauer. I'm a very understanding guy. You got guys that like that, and I see their point. They want to make the game exciting, you know, but I feel like there's a different way to do it. I don't appreciate it. I don't like it. You know, that's my personal opinion. And I guess your third question was my favorite food, favorite place to go on the road.
Favorite place to eat on the road, yeah.
Yeah, favorite place to eat on the road, and this is so funny. Like I said, my best friend got traded to the New York Giants when I was up here. So him and I lived together, and Clifton, New Jersey for a long time, and we traveled. He's from Columbus, Ohio, so we would always travel back to Columbus and back to Wheeling together for my charity event and his stuff. And both of our favorite place, it's the same exact place, it's at his Waffle House. In the South, we had all the time, and then going back to Columbus, Ohio, they have it there. So Waffle House getting an all-star special with an orange juice is like heaven on earth. However, afterwards, you know, we would time each other to see who could get to the bathroom the fastest, but I don't care how that felt. It was that food going in is amazing. I love Waffle House. But you guys, what's y'all's favorite?
No, JJ, I was just gonna throw it out there that, like, sometimes a lot of, like, brand names and chains, they get hatred. And it's like you had to get there somehow.
Exactly.
Yeah.
At Waffle House, I don't care where I'm at or what I'm doing. I could be leaving a wedding in a suit and tie. If I see a Waffle House on the way home, I'm stopping and getting an all-star special. Like, it's just my favorite food on earth. It's my fucking feel-good food.
I did have the Waffle House when I went to see the Braves down in Atlanta in the new place, and they had a Waffle House stand in right field, and I expected the line to be out the door, but it was long enough before the game that I was able to get there right up front, and I had the peanut butter chip waffle and the Texas toast cheesesteak, and they were very, very good. The one thing I missed out on that everybody told me I should have had was the hash browns. The next time I got to have the hash browns.
Well, how long did it take for you to run to the bathroom after that? Are you one of the soldiers that held it in?
You know what? I think I was one of the soldiers, but if I ran to the bathroom, I blocked it out of my memory. Because I don't tend to remember that. I just remember how good that food was.
Yeah, that's my favorite. What a good question. I remember I was talking to a panel that was on Top Gear, and everybody's asking all these car questions to the Stig on the show, this guy that came in. 200 people asking all these car questions. They come to me and are like, hey, what are you going to ask them? I said, so what's your favorite whiskey? Like, you got to travel to all these countries driving these cars. What's your favorite whiskey? So I love that question. That thing's awesome. That's awesome.
Oh, tremendous. Tremendous.
No,
thanks for all the answers.
Perfect.
That was great stuff. Great stuff.
And can I just say also that the only time that I've ever run to the bathroom in a stadium that was of my opposition was Yankee Stadium, and they immediately rallied with the Mets in a 3-1 lead in the seventh. The Yankees immediately rallied when I came back. So never again in any stadium will I do that. But anyway, JJ, before we let you go, this is just tremendous stuff. First of all, thank you so much for being on the podcast. It's been wonderful. And I wanted to ask you, we always send it over to our guests before they go for their final word as well as shameless plug. Anywhere you would like anybody out there to know how to find you.
Oh, that's amazing. So the shameless plug would be what? My Instagram or Facebook is JJ Newman. 9 is Instagram, and you can find me on Facebook. I'm actually never on Twitter. I'm one of the few guys that have done that or haven't done it. Like, I have a Twitter, but I'm barely ever on it. I'm actually not much of a social media guy. Like, I post once every couple years maybe. But there are people. I just sent a bat out in the mail, a guy reached out to me from Indiana on my Instagram. He was a college kid that I guess saw me on there, and he asked me to send him a game used bat sign. As I just sent it out 2 days ago. Sometimes I'll get requests like that, and I answer them as quick as possible. But that's at JJ Newman 9 on Instagram. But other than that, like, I'm not much of a social media guy, but that's where you can find me on there.
Excellent, man. JJ, we appreciate you joining the Metsian podcast, and we will let you go. Thank you so much, man, for joining us.
Awesome. Anytime you guys need me, I'm there for you, Sam. I really appreciate the invite. And thanks, guys, for the questions and everything. It was awesome.
Thank you.
I'll see you next time you're in the city, JJ.
Hey, you got it, brother. You guys take it easy. Take care.
Travel safe.
Later, JJ.
All right, thanks. Later, guys.
So, guys, first of all, thank you again to JJ Newman, former Mets draft pick. It's pretty amazing. And like I said, Rich, I'll start with you. There's many different ways of making it.
Yes. Was that to me, Sam?
Yes, Rich.
Oh, yeah, sorry. Yeah, there are many different ways of making it, right? And so you got to respect JJ and everything he was talking about. You know, I read his clip or you know little write up that you had on the write up for the podcast. He was drafted. You know, he played a season, then he got hurt, and then he played independent ball. And like he said, you know, instead of walking away from the game and you know in anger or feeling sorry for himself, he's leaned into it. You know, he's doing all this coaching and he's teaching kids and he's trying to teach them to play the way that I think is the right way, you know, without the bat flips and without the jawing and without the showboating and all that stuff. So, you know, he's turned that experience that he had into a positive, you know, that he could help raise the next generation of players in what he thinks is the right way to play the game. So I thought it was great.
John, you know, I think you really uncovered some excellent material and excellent content with your questions, just to throw you a compliment first.
No, well, thank you, but JJ really deserves the plaudits for his great answers. I really enjoyed listening to him talk about the different perspectives of minor league players as he was coming up, talking about the wages and then talking about how he feels about the backflips and the story he told is just, it sticks with you. But I think what sticks with me most about him is that, you know, listen, everybody, we're such a mean culture now on social media. When he said he wasn't really a social media guy, and I don't blame him because it's not fun out there anymore on social media, and everybody, when somebody who played professional baseball but didn't make the major leagues, and there's no crime in that, comes out with opinions and whatnot, you know, people tend to try to knock them down. But what I get from JJ is that he's just somebody who doesn't feel like he was cheated at all, that he gave it his best go, and that he's happy with how everything has turned out. And he's now a successful head coach, and he's going to continue to be a successful head coach. And in a lot of ways, yeah, he has made it. He has made it maybe in certain ways more than some players who've been in the major leagues have quote unquote made it. So it was really just fascinating to listen to him and appreciate his time and his stories here.
Agreed. And you know, we still have so much to go over in terms of the 2023 Mets, but I'm really happy that JJ Newman was able to be on this podcast. I thought it was a really good angle to go into spring with, and I'm very happy that JJ was able to be on here. You are listening to the Metsian podcast. We're almost to an hour, and appropriately so. We still have a lot to go over. But Rich, I'm going to throw it to you first, since you did mention there's still a few other things that you'd like the Mets to do.
Yeah, there are. And one of them being adding another lefty in the bullpen. You know, I don't know, maybe it's traditionalist thinking, but dialing back to what we talked about at the very beginning of the show, about the starting pitching and how to space these guys out a bit. You may see some of Tylor McGill, you may see some of David Peterson, some of Joey Lucchese in spot starting roles to try and lengthen out, you know, the time between starts for the guys at the top. Okay, so that being the case, probably Peterson, I mean, he could be a swing man. I understand that. Lucchese the same. But you may want to add a solid lefty reliever into that bullpen. I do see that as a need. And the Mets were one of six teams looking at Zach Britton this week. Apparently, he had a showcase earlier in the offseason, and all 30 teams went to see him. And now for the second one, the Mets were one of six. So they obviously have interest. There's the Buck Showalter connection we all know about. The, quote, drawback to Britton that I'm hearing that you probably have heard as well is that the Mets prefer to have bullpen guys who they can send up and down, which they all do it, right? Because, you know, if a guy pitched three innings and that's not something he's accustomed to doing, you know, maybe it's a the starter gets pounded, you need a reliever. What do? The next day they send the guy down, and they bring somebody else up, a fresh arm. Somebody like a Zach Britton you can't send down because of his veteran stature, right, or status. So they, I guess, have – it's not so much Britton himself, but the desire to have guys they could send down, obviously mainly younger pitchers. That is one of their bigger concerns about why they might not go down the pathway of signing Zach Britton, but I do think they need another established lefty. You know, Rayleigh can't pitch every day. You can't burn this guy out. I don't believe you could count on Lucchese and Peterson as lefties out of the bullpen when they might be needed elsewhere. So, yeah, I know you like to send guys up and down. I get it. Every team does it, but I don't know. If you have an established veteran like that who knows the manager, the Mets clearly do have interest. If they're one of six teams looking at him this week, I'd say bring him in. I'd like to see them bring him in. That's my primary ask for the rest of the offseason.
Excellent stuff. Metrodamus, go ahead.
I'm going to agree with Rich here. For the simple matter of you haven't skimped on anything else this offseason. You went and got the AL Cy Young Award winner. And then you almost landed Carlos Correa to a deal that would have sent your payroll with the luxury tax well over $500 million. So I would say in that instance, why not go and get Zach Britton? I've always hated the term low risk, high reward. Always hated that. And maybe it was an outreach of the type of ownership that we had before, where everybody was a low risk, high reward guy. But Zach Britton is you've got everything else in place. You've got Rayleigh. You've got Ottavino. You've, of course, you got Edwin Diaz, but you have enough guys that you can send up and down. Why not get that next level left-hander? I feel like everybody's been waiting for Andrew Chafin to sign with the Mets, and I think until the end of Chafin's career, he's going to be forever linked to the Mets, no matter where he goes. He's like the Jay Bruce of his generation. But if you can get a guy that the manager is familiar with, and there are some guys on the Mets who are there who have been there last year because Buck was familiar with them, why not take a flyer on him? It doesn't make it – if he flames out, then you can go to your guys that you could send up and down. But if it works, if he can find something to be, you know, a second lefty, you know, they would just ask him to be a second lefty out of the bullpen, not their closer like he was for the Yankees in certain stretches. Second lefty out of the bullpen, and if he doesn't work out, it doesn't work out. So I'm going to agree wholeheartedly with Rich, only because I'm not sure what else they can do with other positions that they've already filled. I think if they need another bat, it's going to come from the minor leagues when they decide to call up Francisco Alvarez for good. I don't think that day is here yet. And I think if they need a starting pitcher, I think they could always get one at the trade deadline if one of the back end starting pitchers isn't getting the job done, or God forbid, Scherzer or Verlander suffer a significant injury. As I knock on my wooden wall unit as I say that, I think they can handle everything else. But if they can get that one extra bullpen piece like Britton, I think it'll work for them.
Exactly. I would have to agree with you, and that's a perfect segue, John, over to Rich for the Alvarez-Beatty conversation. Where do you go this season with Francisco Alvarez and Brett Beatty?
All right. So I don't know. Somebody's going to have to convince me that having him on the team, and hear me out on this one, is a positive at the start of the season. Here's what I mean. What I mean is he's not going to catch. He's not. You have Nito, who's a very good defensive backstop. You have Narvaez, who obviously brought him in here for a reason, you know, to play. And I think it's kind of an accepted theory that if Alvarez is on the team, he's primarily going to be a right-handed DH. And sure, if you get to, and we don't see this anymore, the 15th inning of a game or something like that, and you have to, and you need a backup catcher, of course. But he's not going to become better at his defensive skills by being a DH, obviously. He's not really going to become a better hitter of major league pitching by being a part-time DH. So I don't know what the real benefit would be of having him for him and ultimately for the team to have him on the roster on opening day. Now, the caveat to that is we have a month of spring training baseball. If he should absolutely light it up in Port St. Lucie to a point where the Mets say, we have no choice, you have to bring him north, then maybe you do something with Nito, maybe you try to deal Narvaez or something like that, and then you find a spot for him. But that's highly unlikely that he could perform to that level. So I think it's in his best interest and the best interest of the team to have him start the year in AAA. We've heard that feel as though he, quote, has not hit his defensive metrics. So right there, he has to catch. He has to catch to get better. Let him catch in AAA. If he needs to come up in the middle of the season, Narvaez is on a one-year deal. You could always do something there. You know, you can get rid of Narvaez. You can trade him. You can dump him off somewhere. Who knows? But I really think that is the plan, that he will start the year in AAA. And with Beatty, let me start with this. Hell no to having him in the outfield, okay? You don't spend a $400 million on a payroll to have on-the-job training for a guy. Are you kidding me? I mean, that cannot be a consideration. You cannot be serious about having this guy, who I think he's played four games in the outfield or parts of four games, on a team that has this payroll that is expecting to win, having on-the-job training. This isn't the Pirates. You know, this isn't the Miami Marlins. You don't have a guy in left field who's never played the position. We saw how bad Dom Smith was. Just stop with that nonsense. If you want him to be a left fielder, let him play left field for a year in the minor leagues, fine. Let him learn the craft down there. So if you look at Beatty, in my opinion, no way, no how does he play the outfield. He also has missed his defensive metrics at third base. So you have Escobar, who I know he, you know, 5 months were bad and 1 month was really good. But tell me if I'm wrong, guys, but to me, the third baseman is Escobar. Beatty gets better at AAA, and like Alvarez, he can come up when he needs to. But you have a guy who they're saying, yeah, he might be a good prospect, but, quote, I say it for the last time, he has not hit his metrics. Let him go down there and hit those metrics. You have good backups, both behind the plate. Good, I shouldn't say backups. You have good alternative plans behind the plate and at third base, and go with those guys for now. That's my opinion.
I think John, you're absolutely right. Yeah.
John, may I just say, Matt, John, before you go, I just want to say I just think it was a little funny jab / callback on Rich's part to the Pittsburgh Pirates. I just wanted to throw that out there. But nice job, Rich. Go ahead, John.
in some ways, I think they would want to have one of them up and contribute. And I think the performance of Beatty is kind of tied to Alvarez a little bit, perhaps, because you've got like you said, there is Eduardo Escobar. But the question is, where is he going to play? Is he going to be their right-handed designated hitter, or is he going to be their third baseman? I think if Beatty comes in and plays a hellacious third base, continues to hit his metrics and hits the cover off the ball, then I don't think they can ignore it. Like you said, if Francisco Alvarez hits the cover off the ball, he's going to be up. I think the same with Beatty. If Beatty hits the cover off the ball, he's going to be up. Escobar is going to play a lot of designated hitter, and then that lessens the need to have Francisco Alvarez be your right-handed pop, which I think the Mets would prefer if that happened, like you said. I think the plan is if they want him to be a catcher, then he's got to start in the minor leagues. And you would think that they would want him to be a catcher since they brought up since they went and signed Omar Narvaez, and everybody wondered, well, why, since you have Alvarez? Well, that's why, because you want Alvarez to be ready when he comes up. Not just I can hit a home run off a Marlin or off a Washington National in October ready, but ready in all facets of the game. So I think the performance of Brett Baty this spring training is going to tell a lot of the story about where everybody is. And then the other offshoot of that is that if you have to start both of them in the minor leagues, then guess who's going to get at-bats earlier in the season? Our buddy, Darren Ruff. So chew on that.
Oh, Jesus. See, Rich, you know, I thought I was going to go to you with something completely different, but Darren Ruff's still on this roster. Would you expect that the Mets will cut ties with him sometime this spring training, or do you think this could be, you know, one of the bounce-back comeback players of the year?
I think Darren Ruff is a wild card, and so Duquette also spoke about that. So there's a chance. You know, Darren Ruff had a horrific time. I mean, we're not going to sugarcoat that. But he also has a career of, you know, a career mark of being able to really mash left-handed pitching, and that's why he was brought here. He was hitting left-handed pitching well, but he just did not do it here. So, you know, if he shows that he has regained his, I don't know, form, confidence, whatever you want to call it, in spring training, I could absolutely see Darren Ruff making the team because he's a veteran right-handed bat who was brought in here to hit lefties. And if he shows he could do it and it was an anomaly, then sure, give him a chance. I have no problem with that. Duquette also spoke to this. He also spoke to, you know, the Mets gave up, I don't know, how much of a prospect was that left-handed pitcher? Sabucki. You know, how much of a prospect was he? They gave up, I believe, three prospects. We don't know how good these prospects were to get Ruff. And he said, if you're in the front office, and you bring in a guy like that, and he absolutely tanks for whatever the reason, and you gave him three prospects, you're a little bit loath to just cut bait with him right away. So I think the Mets are going to give Ruff a serious look in spring training, give him every opportunity to show that he could still hit left-handed pitching. They probably hope that he does. To Duquette's point, they probably hope that he does. They probably hope he makes the team and that he does well, so they can get some of the egg off their face for the trade. But I do think he'll have a fair shot. And look, we're rooting for the guy, right? I mean, he's got the blue and orange on. We root for him. And I hope he does have a great spring. And I hope he does make the team and mash left-handed pitching. And I hope Vogelbach mashes right-handed pitching. Until these guys are gone, they're Mets. And, you know, and we give them a fair shot to do what they have to do.
You know, Rich, I have to segue to this real quick since you mentioned that. I was once at I told this story on some podcast, whether it be here or other, that I parted with the Mets sometime in 2012, and I saw Kelly Shopik at, where I said this to Kelly Shopik was not the club, but the benefit that I saw in that. And I said to him, welcome to the Mets family. And he seemed, this was in September 2012 when he had only been here since the end of July maybe. And he genuinely was like, thanks, man. Appreciate that. And that's something that is, Kelly Shopik will always be part of the Mets family. And like you said, Rich, there's just until he's not a Met, he is a Met. And that's how it works. Like you were in that orange and blue uniform. And until you take that off, you are not, you know, you are a part of the family. So you have been listening to the Metsian podcast, which involves the orange and blue, of course. And before we go, we'd be remiss if we didn't talk about, you know, takes the orange and blue off, but always a Met, the late, great Tim McCarver. I will start with you, Metstradamus. Excuse me, so I'm stumbling over my words at the end of this podcast.
Metstradamus, that's a good one. I like that.
John Coppinger. Thank you. exactly.
We've been talking a lot about Mr. Coppinger. Yes. We've been talking a lot lately.
I need to hydrate again.
No, go for it. Get some Gatorade. So, you know, we've been talking a lot about how the trio of Gary, Keith, and Ron has surpassed, tied, and will surpass the trio of Ralph Kiner, Bob Murphy, and Lindsay Nelson in terms of lore, Mets announcing lore. And for people that grew up in that era, in Ralph and Bob and Lindsay's era, that's amazing to think about how Keith, Gary, Keith, and Ron are going to surpass them in longevity, which is really amazing, and it's proof that nothing lasts forever, right? When we talk about those two trios in Mets history, the bridge from one to the other, for the most part, was Tim McCarver. And I barely remember – I came in as my Met fandom at the tail end of Lindsay's tenure. So the guy that really taught me the game of baseball is Tim McCarver through his announcing on Mets telecasts. He was, for that era, and probably for any era, one of the greats of baseball broadcasting, not just for the Mets, but nationally as well. And people have said that near the end of his career, he got a little bitter and a little salty. And, listen, it happens to the best of us. Not everybody can be Vin Scully, right? But Tim really taught me the game of baseball. The reason I'm here with you guys, the reason I blog and talk about baseball on podcasts and whatnot, and the reason that I love this game, the reason that I can confidently come and try to sound smart about this game, even though I'm really not, is Tim McCarver. Now, would he want to take blame for that? Probably not. But he taught a lot of people, a lot of baseball fans, the ins and outs of baseball and made it enjoyable. His time with Ralph Kiner, his time with Steve Zabriskie, he made it enjoyable and light and fun while teaching you a thing or two along the way. So, and on a personal note also, I actually interviewed Tim McCarver. It was about 25 years ago. About a charity that he was doing. I think it was No Tobacco Day that he was sponsoring.
Wow.
And he was such a joy to talk to, and it was such a blur because I was so nervous. And I was probably 27, 28 years old, and I was so nervous because this was the guy that taught me baseball. I don't even remember what he said. I don't even remember what I said. I remember him telling me a joke, and I laughed so hard out of nervousness, out of discomfort, that I probably made a fool of myself to this guy. But when you look back at the pantheon of Mets announcers, I don't think anybody can forget the contributions that Tim McCarver made to Mets fans who grew up with this team in that time.
Tim, if I may.
Rich.
I'm sorry. Go
ahead. No, I was just going to say that my first introduction, other than Fox broadcasting, it sucks to say this, but, I mentioned I was a converted Mets fan from Yankees, and Tim McCarver and Bob Mercer at some point were paired together on Yankee broadcasting, and it was yet another time that the Yankees took something that had formerly been the Mets, but that was my first introduction to Tim McCarver.
Yeah. So for me, kind of like John, not to sound sappy about it, but my dad died when I was 8. So, and he was very into sports, but gone at a very young age. So I'm watching these games with Lindsay, Ralph, and Bob, and those guys I had my uncles and stuff. When I would see them, they would talk about sports, but who else is teaching you this stuff? They did. They taught me as a little kid, what baseball was all about, what to look for. And then, like John said, by the time I was, a little bit older and had a foundational knowledge, here comes Tim McCarver in 1983. And his way of explaining the game from a catcher's perspective was unparalleled. I mean, honestly, it was. I know people who said they didn't like his southern accent, people who said they didn't like that he talked too much and all that kind of thing.
his knowledge of the game, I could have listened to him 24/7 because as a catcher, 21 years in big leagues as a catcher, he had a perspective. I'm going to give you one quick story of McCarver's story that I think summarizes everything. So 1983, I'll never forget this, 1983, Mets are playing the Cubs in a late September game, obviously a meaningless game. Both teams, you know, were not doing well. And so the Cub pitcher shakes twice. So he shakes off the pitch, no, and then a second later does no again, right? McCarver, before the pitcher goes into the windup, says, this is going to be a curveball. And the pitch this is going to be a fastball. So it's going to be a fastball. And sure enough, it's a fastball. The Met hitter, of course, I forgot who it was, is ready for it. Home run, right? And I think what McCarver exactly said was, this is going to be a fastball, and the hitter should be ready for it. Pitch is thrown, fastball, home run. McCarver goes, I don't know what the Cubs were doing there. He goes, well, I'll tell you why. The hitter knew that was a fastball because he shook twice. He shook the pitch and then he shook location. And he said, if you're throwing a curveball, there's not a second one because there's no location given for a curveball. He goes, so he shook off curve, which means throwing a fastball. Then the second shake off, he was shaking off location. So when they shake off twice in a row like that, the second one is location, which means it's a fastball. And he said that, a veteran pitcher knows not to do that. There are ways around that. They don't shake the head. They might do something else because if it's done twice, it indicates the kind of pitch. It's unique to a fastball. I remember that, and he said it.
Do you remember who the hitter was?
It was, 1983. I mean, maybe a Hubie Brooks. You know, I don't know. I'm trying to think of who it was. He said it, and you guys watch football too. If you remember – a lot of people are giving Tony Romo a lot of credit in the 2019 Patriots Chiefs AFC Championship game when he was calling the plays before they were happening because he knew the way the coaches were thinking. He knew what was going to happen. And that's when, if you remember, he was like lauded for that. Like, oh my God, this Romo guy, he's clairvoyant. He knows every play before it happens. Not most, every play. Well, this is like a mini of that. With McCarver, where he's like, Ralph, fastball coming. The hitter's got to be ready. You know, you shook twice. Second one's location. You don't do location on a curveball or any kind of breaking ball. Bang, out of the ballpark. And that's just a snippet of what McCarver did. You know,
well, and the video that was making the rounds today was him saying that during the 2001 World Series, right before Luis Gonzalez's hit, that Mariano Rivera's cutter was open to being hit in the shallow outfield because it bores in on hitters, and hitters will just make enough contact to get it to that short outfield. So playing the infield in might be a problem, and then you saw what happened. So that clairvoyance lasted for all his career.
That's right. His perspective on the game. I mean, come on, find somebody who's better. Smoltz. A lot of people don't like Smoltz. Smoltz is good with pitching. You know, he does know pitching. Like, he's able to kind of do it. Nobody had the command of the panoramic view of the game like McCarver. And he was entertaining. I mean, come on. Maybe he
so
got
you
there,
guys
you know,
think,
and all that.
Do you guys think, and I'll go to you first, Rich, and then to John immediately after. Do you guys think he changed the game of color commenting? Commentating.
I do.
He certainly
really
had an
do.
Impact on it. Absolutely.
So, do you think that was partially having to do with the Keith Hernandez negotiations, considering you just said, John, they're about to overtake Bob, Lindsay, and Ralph as a trio for Mets baseball in terms of longevity?
Right. So what was the what's the question? I didn't understand.
Basically, segued over to the Keith Hernandez negotiations, and I wondered when you mentioned that they're about to overtake Bob, Lindsay, and Ralph. You're wondering whether in the modern age, Keith Hernandez's agent, when within the TV ranks, kind of understood that was partially Keith's one of three. Negotiation, what Keith hold within negotiations is the fact that they're about to overtake them. And that's partially what the reason they're about to overtake them is because that trio is as iconic in Mets baseball as Bob, Lindsay, and Ralph.
Yeah, it could have been a lot. It could have been that. It could have been a lot of things. You know, I think just for the fact that Keith knows his worth, Keith's agent knows his worth, and in terms of worth to the trio, I don't know if they are who they are. If it's just two of them or one of them, you need all three. And a lot of people have said to me, you know, I like those guys, but when one of them's off, it's not nearly the same. So if you had had a booth of Gary and Ron, they would do an excellent job, but it wouldn't be the same. And again, listen, we know nothing lasts forever, and one day Keith is going to retire. And I think also you're talking about that you don't want that to end this way with a failed contract negotiation. You want those guys, and Keith will probably be the first one because he's the oldest. You want Keith to have that farewell tour, you know, because you know it would be hilarious. A Keith Hernandez farewell tour would be the funniest TV going. So I do think, seriously, and I think there's a lot of factors that went into, hey, come on, let's bring Keith. And I will say I'm really shocked that it's a three-year deal. I'm very happy it's a three-year deal, but I was not sure that he would come back and commit himself to three more, especially since he said on other talk shows that, you know, he doesn't like the way the game is going. He made his comments about the Phillies. I can't stand watching him play. You know, it sounded like a guy who had one foot out the door, but I'm very happy that he's back, very surprised and happy that he's back for 3 years. And I do think there's a lot of factors that went into that. In addition to, hey, let's have these guys surpass the record.
So rest in peace, Tim McCarver, but segueing within that, the idea of Tim McCarver changing the game for future color commentators like Keith Hernandez. Rich, what say you?
Well, I think what happened is, you know, the idea of a color commentator, McCarver took it to the next level. That's my opinion. We don't see every color commentator, so it's hard to say that McCarver is solely responsible. But think about it. 1983 is when he began his broad. I think he had done the Phillies for a year or two, so he had maybe begun in 1981 or 82 with the Phillies, and then he comes to the Mets, which is clearly where he made his chop. So what was color commentating like before that? I'd have to say McCarver did raise the bar quite a bit. I mean, you had Bill White doing the Yankee games, the former player, and you had Ralph Kiner doing the Met games, former player, and that's what we saw in this area. So all due respect to Ralph Kiner, all due respect to Bill White, were those guys on the level of McCarver? I'm going to say no. I mean, respectfully, but no. So McCarver came in as the color commentator, you know, the third person in the baseball booth, the ex-jock, and really ratcheted up the whole thing, you know, and I think that's what you see now. I think you see networks and regional sports networks are being they're being very selective in who they hire to be their color person, because again, it's not just, hey, I'm Ralph Kiner, I'm a former player, I make some malaprops, you know, I call Gary Carter, Gary Cooper, everybody loves me, that kind of thing. It's not that anymore. The bar to be in that booth has really been raised, and we can't say it's solely McCarver, but did he have a big hand in that? Yeah. I mean, 1983, that's a long time ago, folks. And he was cutting edge, and I think he did raise the bar. Yeah.
So where are you on the Keith Hernandez negotiations? You know, that's kind of like a silent part of this entire off season. And should point it out that the Wilpons still own the majority, I believe, or relatively speaking, of SNY.
Well, you know, Keith's a gem, you know, and those guys work Gary Cohen's fantastic. And with Darling and Hernandez, and keeping them together, I think, was important. And I'll tell you why I think that. Could the Mets have brought somebody else in? Sure. You know, absolutely. But at the same time, keeping them together, especially now when they're on the precipice of maybe winning, how great would it be to have this group that started SNY, to have them together when the Mets finally get to the top of the baseball world again? And, of course, with wishful thinking, yes, I'm sure I'm saying that too. But so what I'm saying is it's not so much about Keith individually as much as I love the guy. It's more about having this crew that has been with us since 2006, you know, day one of SNY, having this crew see the journey through and be with us when they, or at least have the opportunity to be with us, when the Mets, if the Mets, hope the Mets get to the top of the sports world. So to me, it's more about that.
I would agree, and you have been listening to the Metsian podcast, and we're so thankful that you have been. And what an episode, you guys. You know, thanks to J.J. Newman, former Mets draft pick, for joining the podcast and kind of just covering all bases, not only in terms of what spring training is like for the players down there, but also his own personal experience, and we're so thankful for that. So without further ado, we go on to our final word, and I will start with Mets Stradamus John Coppinger. I slowed down with just saying Mets Stradamus John the whole time, John, so I appreciate that I did that. But what is your final word and shameless plug?
The final word is when you're in this part of the calendar, you just hope nobody gets hurt. And that's really my final word. You're just hoping for good health while also having good success at the World Baseball Classic. I am looking forward to seeing the Mets and to see the whole tournament. I have grown into a fan of the World Baseball Classic. I originally thought that it was just a last-ditch effort for Bud Selig to kind of cement his legacy. But people love it, and with good reason. I think the future of competition, of even mid-season competition, I think it lies in international play. But I do hope that nobody gets hurt. And that's really all you can hope for on this February 16th. Please have good health. Please manage the arms well. But the difference between now and some years back is that I have confidence that this front office and this managerial on the field managerial staff will do the right thing and keep these guys as healthy as they can. There's some things you can't avoid, but listen, if they do what they can to minimize the time that guys will be out, if you don't see Scherzer out for 2 months at a time, I think that's a win. So let's keep these guys healthy and let's move forward. And as for my shameless plug, you know, you can always find me on MetsStradamusBlog.com. But I also do want to – I am undertaking an exciting new project as part of a group project. We have secured the rights to the URL, KinersCorner.com, which is apt because we've been talking about announcers today. So we are launching – we have launched the multimedia platform, KinersCorner.com. We're going to have blogs that I'm going to contribute to. We're going to have fun stuff like Mets crossword puzzles and trivia, and we're going to have interviews and video, and also video post game recaps. Maybe not every game, but post series recaps, and then to preview the next series. So we're going to be on probably twice a week. And we've got an all-star cast. I don't know how I got in this group, but we've got an all-star cast of guys like Mark Rosenman, A.J. Carter, Jim Cerny's involved with this, Howie Carpin's involved, Russ Cohen, and we've got a couple of special contributors who you might have heard of. Howard Johnson and Barry Lyons are going to come in and help us out every so often. So, like I said, all-star cast. I don't know how I broke into that group, but I'm going to do my best to hang on to some coattails and hopefully make it fun for everybody out there. So come and join the follow them, Kindness Corner Web, I believe is the Twitter handle, and there's a Facebook page also, kindnesscorner.com, that you can join. And we hope to see everybody out there. Come and join us for our group chats after our group video chats after series on the website and on the Facebook page.
That's beautiful. Congratulations, John, and thank you for that. And again, thank you for joining us. Without further ado,
anytime. Always
move
enjoy.
On to,
always enjoy it. Thank you, guys.
Oh, it's always a better podcast whenever you are on, John. So thank you again. I'm going to welcome Rich. You got a three-tier job here. You have the World Baseball Classic, your final word, and your shameless plug.
Okay. Not a fan of the World Baseball Classic at all. I get it. I get internationalizing the game. Here's what I don't like about it. I would like it if it were the following. Let the college kids play. You see it with the Yankees. They pulled, a guy, I forget who it was actually, one of their starters. They Nestor Cortez. Buck made the statement, I don't mind my guys playing, I want him to get hurt. Let's just call a spade a spade. Every major league team that has players playing in that thing are worried about their players getting hurt, rightfully so. It's not, these guys are oodles of money. Baseball fans want to see their guys, I'm sorry, but the average baseball fan would rather see their team win and have their team intact then say, yay, USA won the World Baseball Classic. I mean, come on. It's not even in the same conversation. So I think it's a big risk that they're taking with very highly paid athletes. The national pride thing of it all, I know in the Latin countries they take it, very, very seriously, and that's fine. And, again, I'm not opposed to the U.S. having a team in there or using Major League Baseball players. Or using players of those nationalities, but please let's use college athletes. Let's not subject these highly paid players to this. You can have your national pride like the Olympics. It's for amateurs, right? Do it that way. Don't have these guys playing. Nobody, and I will say this definitively, not one person associated with any Major League Baseball team is in favor of this. Mark my words, they hate the crap out of it. And I do, too, for that reason. Have it, but use amateurs. That's my opinion. Okay, next. In terms of you wanted the last word. There was some – shameless plug. Mesmerized Online, I dropped a couple articles recently. I do the rule changes and the business stuff. One of that I wrote just the other day was around expect to see more balks in baseball this year because of the pitch clock and guys hurrying their deliveries. But also, if you didn't see this, Major League Baseball told the umpires to enforce the balk rule like 1988, just the same way they did before 1988. So now you've got guys with a pitch clock changing their motions. You have Major League Baseball telling the umpires to enforce the balk. Yes, that's going to encourage more stolen bases, but we're going to have a lot of balks this year, folks. So anyway, you can see that stuff on Mesmerized Online. My final word is go. That's it. Go with an exclamation point. It's time. We have real baseball games starting in 8 days. Mets play in 9 days. It's go time. It's been, like John said earlier, we had a quick start to the offseason, dearth of stuff lately. We're all a little bit chomping at the bit, and it's here, so go.
Go indeed, and thank you for that, Rich. In terms of the World Baseball Classic, I will say – I get where all the angles are coming from. I've enjoyed it the hell out of it. And David Wright got his nickname from that. Shout out to Matt, that excursion for that. That's where Captain America was born, was the World Baseball Classic, even if it were against Italy. Sorry to disparage the Italian baseball team. It's going to be an interesting World Baseball Classic because Great Britain made it for the first time, and that is definitely an interesting, evolution of this international ball play. So we'll see how Great Britain does, because they have made the World Baseball Classic, and it just dawned on me as we're talking about it, that that is indeed the case. So let's see how they do in that round robin, which I'm guessing
and with,
is still
and with British baseball legend Jazz Chisholm on the team as well.
There you go.
Right. So, John,
I feel bad because in 2016 again?
No, how did that happen, that Jazz is on the British team?
I think he visited Britain once. I think the rules are really lax for the – no, I think he has, like, a grandmother that's actually from Great Britain. So, and I feel bad because in 2016, I saw all those teams play in the qualifying tournament in Brooklyn. I saw Pakistan play Brazil. And then I came back and saw the championship game, which was Great Britain losing to Team Israel, and that's how Team Israel got in and made their crazy run in 2017. But I feel bad because I didn't realize until last year that Jazz Chisholm was on the Great Britain team. I had no idea, and I went back. I'm like, did I get any pictures of him by accident? And then, stupidly, no. But but yeah, I think that's going to be a lot of fun to see guys on those second tier teams how they perform.
Well, Great Britain is so random, you know, like Amsterdam, you kind of understand because there's some connection, weirdly enough, probably to colonialism. But, it's going to be, again, thank you for mentioning it because it's just, I have enjoyed it. And I get why it's a nuisance, Rich. I get why it's a nuisance. But I'm very, very happy that it's back because I'm going to enjoy putting it on in the bar that I work at, Rudy's Bar and Grill, shameless plug, come by for a shot, beer, and a hot dog. Anyway, thank you for listening to the Metsian Podcast, and we have come to me. First of all, thank you again to former player J.J. Newman for joining the podcast, giving us such great perspective on what it's like around this time for a player, as well as his own unique journey within baseball and how, like I said earlier, there's many different ways of making it, even if you get drafted and you don't make it to the major leagues. People love this game, and I love this game, and I continue to love this game as I get into other sports and continue to love other sports. Baseball is still the anchor for me when it comes to sports, and the Mets are still my anchor within the baseball ranks, and I'm going to L.A. next week, a much-needed time off, and I am going to only bring – the only jacket I'm going to bring is my Mets jacket from 2012. So it is now almost 11 years old because I got it around the time of my birthday. It might even be I might have gotten it, around the time of my birthday. It might have come directly on my birthday, so it is directly 11 years old at this point. And I can't wait to put another patch on it, and I am saving that for a special kind of patch because the only patch I've put on it is the Mets logo on the left sleeve, and I can't wait to fill the right sleeve with, you guys know what, without me jinxing it, the patch that I want to put on that right sleeve, and I hope it starts in spring of 2023. And that's what we're all here for. So what is my last word? Change the narrative. We won 101 games last year, but we still couldn't get it done. We blew the division. We blew it in the wild card. And I hate to use that word because it's associated with us for so many decades. But at some point, no matter what the current payroll situation is, we need to change the narrative. We are clearly changing the narrative when it comes to the way we run our franchise with the owners that are in charge, even though JJ brought some things up within the minor league ranks that impressed me about the Wilpon era a little bit more than the narrative that we've heard. Still, I've heard it's a 180-degree turnaround for the people that work within the corporate ranks of this Mets franchise. So it's time to translate that within year three to the field. 3 to 5 years. Here we go with 3 years that is exactly the window that Steve Cohen was talking about. Let us go, like Rich said, go, but change the narrative as we begin this new journey. And again, appreciate J.J. Newman, appreciate John Coppinger, Metrodamus. Thank you guys so much for joining us, and the only way to end this is let's go Mets. Take care, everybody.
Let's go Mets. Travel safe. Everybody. Thanks, John.